aquí. Que estuviste en mi cama amarrándote a mis ganas, sé que fuiste tú. ¿Cómo puedo yo decirte que eres hoy, pero ya fuiste, sos un déjà vu?
Welcome to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at citr.ca.
Today is Monday, October.
Today is Monday, October the 1st. I am Phil Chang.
And I'm Claire Eagle, and today we'll be bringing you news from campus, news from Vancouver community, as well as news from the national and international. Today we'll be bringing you news from campus, news from the national and international community, as well as some stories written by our very own News 101 reporters.
So...
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. There's nothing.
Good evening. It is 5:04 p.m. and time for another almost full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Today we have a story from our new News 101 reporter Najin Razian about an Engineers Without Borders fair at BCIT, and an interview with UBC Department of Fisheries Assistant Professor William Chung about a new study that's just come out. We'll also be bringing you our regular segments, Simply Science and Dietetics Intuition.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast brought to you by the UBC Storm Club right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now we go to campus and local headlines.
The University of British Columbia's Board of Governors has approved a comprehensive housing program designed to help more UBC faculty, staff, and students live on its Vancouver campus. As a result, UBC will expand housing for its academic community and workforce on campus, becoming the only Lower Mainland employer to offer significant levels of restricted housing to employees, and one of the world's first universities to offer nonprofit housing to low-income staff. Up to 30% of UBC's future housing will be made available only to faculty and staff under restricted housing programs. Up to 20% of future units will be available to staff or faculty as restricted rentals. And up to 10% of future units will be restricted home ownership for faculty. UBC will also introduce a pilot nonprofit housing program intended for full-time staff with household incomes of less than $64,000 per year. UBC is currently developing a plan to implement the new program soon because the Vancouver campus has stated that it is committed to keeping its student housing, currently the largest in Canada at 9,000 beds, at below market rates.
In memory of their late husband and father, Franklin Liu, Joan and Derek Liu have made a $2 million gift donation to the Faculty of Law at UBC. The announcement was made September the 28th at the one-year anniversary celebration of Allard Hall, the law school's new building. Mr. Liu, who graduated from UBC in 1961, was a successful businessman and an active community member in Vancouver. He passed away in 2006 after a courageous battle with cancer. The gift, part of UBC's Start an Evolution campaign, will create Franklin Liu Innovation Fund, which will fund research and programming for students and faculty at the law school. Mary Ann Bolinski, dean and professor at UBC Law, said, quote, "We are grateful for the generosity of the Liu family and are inspired by Mr. Liu's commitment to education and serving his community. His gift will make a lasting impact on the school and will support many important projects and initiatives aimed at providing the best teaching and learning experiences for our students and faculty," end quote. The law school's forum space, used for special events and lectures, will now be named after Mr. Liu.
The University of British Columbia and Langara College have partnered to create a transfer program to support First Nations, Métis, and Inuit students working towards a university degree. The UBC and Langara Aboriginal Transfer Program, the first of its kind in BC, will offer up to $8,500 in scholarships to Aboriginal students, plus guaranteed admission to UBC's Faculty of Arts and personalized support from Aboriginal advisors at both institutions. Program students will complete one of 2 years of courses at Langara, including a newly created Aboriginal Plus program, which aims to prepare students for academic success through workshops, extracurricular activities, and support from Aboriginal faculty and staff at both institutions. Langara students who meet program requirements will receive guaranteed admission to the Faculty of Arts at UBC's Vancouver campus. By maintaining high academic standards, program students will be eligible for the scholarships.
Last week, the Georgia Strait newspaper quoted former students of former Vancouver Olympic Organizing Committee president and CEO John Furlong as saying that he had physically and mentally abused them. Furlong denied all allegations and accused the newspaper of not performing thorough research. The reporter who researched this article, Laura Robinson, has now stated that she will be countersuing Furlong for allegedly saying that she did not perform her research adequately and intentionally misinforming the public about her ethics when he accused her of having a vendetta against him. Robinson said that throughout the course of her research, she did repeatedly reach out to Furlong via his publicist for comment and further information, but that she only received one reply over the entire year. There is a serious shortage of judges in Richmond. Richmond Provincial Court has just 2.5 judges working weekly, when it needs as many as 4. The only full-time judge is Judge Jane McKinnon. Judge Ron Fratton and Judge Dennis Schmidt share a full-time position, alternating 2 months at a time, while Judge Patrick Chen is the administrative judge. Schmidt splits his time between Richmond and Vancouver provincial courts. Criminal defense lawyer James Tarnall said that Richmond's judge shortage is not a new problem. It's been ongoing in other jurisdictions in British Columbia for the last year or so, he says. It's starting to hit Richmond quite commonly now because there is a shortage of judges, end quote. In Surrey, those looking to set a trial date consider themselves lucky if they get something within 12 months, he says. NDP Attorney General critic Leonard Krog, MLA for Nanaimo, said there are already examples of criminals walking free because of excessive court delays caused by the shortages.
And those are your UBC campus and local headlines here on CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to take a quick break, but please do stay with us for your segment Simply Science, as well as our weekday weather forecast.
I knew I had a problem.
Eating and eating.
I felt so alone.
We understand. We're Overeaters Anonymous, and we have helped thousands of people just like you start living the life you deserve. Find us on the web at oa.org.
My address is 29 04 Salisbury Street.
I can't understand you. You need to speak English.
Hey, Polly, that remark is totally inappropriate. I know you're new here, but this is a safe harbor office. We're committed to treating all of our clients respectfully.
What would you do if you were this witness? Safe Harbor Respect for All provides diversity workshops across Canada with funding from the Government of Canada. Visit safeharbor.ca. Respect for All. Pass it on.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. It's now time for our weekly segment, Simply Science, with Sarah Chow.
This is Simply Science, bringing you your science news. I'm Sarah Chow. There are many uses for corn, such as starch, biodegradable plastic, sugar, ethanol, and even oil. But corn has another use: to treat lysosomal storage disease. Lysosomal storage disease is a rare, inherited disorder caused by malfunctioning lysosomes. Lysosomes are an important part of the cell because it processes materials the cells don't want and turn it into materials they do want. They do this by using enzymes, which are kind of like catalytic converters, processing one thing to turn it into something else the cell can use, which is the main purpose of lysosomes. But for those who have lysosomal storage disease, they're missing these enzymes that convert cell waste to something useful. So all this waste accumulates and causes symptoms such as movement disorders, seizures, dementia, deafness, blindness, and pulmonary and cardiac problems. Lysosomal storage disease is mostly seen in children who die at an unpredictable age, and it's usually from a symptom of the disorder, not the actual disorder itself. For example, they could die from a seizure or a heart attack. Currently, there is no cure, mostly treatments for symptoms. However, enzyme replacement therapy has been successful in treating this disorder, but it comes with a hefty price, ranging from $300,000 to $500,000 per child. This is because the amount of costly materials required to make these enzymes. But a biologist at Simon Fraser University, Dr. Allison Kermode, may have found a more affordable way to make the enzymes missing in lysosomal storage disease sufferers. Dr. Kermode was able to express the gene to make an enzyme called alpha-L-iduronidase in a kernel of corn. This enzyme is used to treat mucopolysaccharidosis 1, a type of lysosomal storage disorder. The study was published in the journal Nature. This news is important because it provides a more affordable way to make alpha-L-iduronidase, so treatment costs can also be affordable. Unfortunately, this enzyme can only treat one out of the 70 variations of this disorder. But it's a pretty good start, in my opinion. Commuting to and from school on the 99B line is not my favorite thing to do. It's crowded, stuffy, and absolutely hot. But lucky for me, I only have to put up with it for a short amount of time. Naked mole rats, on the other hand, live in tightly crowded, stuffy burrows 24/7. So that's like every day of their lives, and it doesn't bother them at all. In fact, their burrows get so crowded and stuffy, the carbon dioxide they produce accumulates in their tiny living space, creating an acidic environment that other animals would find absolutely intolerable. But for some strange reason, naked mole rats aren't bothered by it too much, which is a good thing, because they may hold the answer to relieving chronic pain. Lingering pain that occurs after injury is caused by acid accumulating in your muscles, like lactic acid. And this type of pain is not relieved by traditional pain relievers like ibuprofen. So how do naked mole rats put up with such acidic environments? Well, researchers know that regular animals are able to sense acidic environments with specialized nerve fibers in their noses. When these nerve fibers are activated by acidic fumes, it stimulates a part of the brain called the trigeminal nucleus, which is a bunch of nerves in the brainstem. The animal's nose will start to secrete mucus, realize it's in danger, and eventually leave. Naked mole rats, on the other hand, don't do that. Researchers at the University of Illinois have found that the trigeminal nucleus, the part of the brain that senses acidic environments, is not as active in these cave dwellers as normal animals. This could be a clue to understanding how naked mole rats tolerate acidic environments and how it can help us alleviate chronic pain. Ever wonder how a cat gets its stripes? How about how cheetahs get their spots? And why are some cats striped? And some have blotchy patches? Well, these questions have actually had scientists stumped for many years. Until researchers at Stanford University, in collaboration with research institutions all over the world, may have discovered the gene responsible for determining whether a cat will have spots or stripes. It's called transmembrane aminopeptidase Q, or TACPEP for short. If a cat has mutations in both their copies of the TACPEP gene, it will have a patchy or blotchy design on their fur, much like a typical tabby cat will have. If the cat has only one mutation, they will be striped, like a tiger or a mackerel tabby. This same mutation in the TACPEP gene is also found in cheetahs, specifically the king cheetah, a rare striped cheetah only found in sub-Saharan regions of Africa. But what about the different colors of their fur? What gene determines that? Well, researchers also found a gene called EDN3 that produces black or darker colored fur on animals. They tested this by genetically engineering yellow colored lab mice to express EDN3. They found these mice grew coats that were much darker in color than the group without EDN3. So, what about fishes, salamanders, and frogs that have spots or stripes? Do they have this gene too? Well, they actually don't, because as they grow, the number of spots or stripes they have increases. Mammals, on the other hand, maintain the same number of spots, stripes, and patterns as they grow. So how they look is already predetermined at birth, which I think is pretty interesting. So researchers concluded the gene TACPEP determines the pattern of the animal, and EDN3 determines the color. That's it for this week for Simply Science. For CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, I'm Sarah Chow.
And thank you to Sarah Chow for bringing us that weekly science segment. Once again, you can listen to that on our website, citr.ca/news. We are going to take a quick break, but do stay with us.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the UBC Westside area at
The Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books, The Bike Kitchen, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Grill, Gumdrops, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca. Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beach Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
It's not just rich people that own the media.
But by leaving out the most important things you need to know, they can elevate awareness to a new all-time low.
I own my media.
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 The Media Co-op is a grassroots national news network that's owned by its members.
But if it's just left out, can you say the paper lied? A lot of things that happened didn't happen after all. If there's no one in the forest who will put it in the news, I guess the tree didn't fall.
Join us today at mediacoop.ca/join.
I'm joining today. You should too.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm your host, Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Phil Chang.
We now go to our weekly health segment brought to you by our health team, Dietetic Intuition, on your low-cost eating options.
Welcome to your weekly health beat on CITR 101.9 FM.
It's Dietetic Intuition, your source for precise nutrition advice.
What are you going to hear? We'll bust nutrition myths, give tips, do book reviews, as well as interviews, you name it. And now here are your dietetic students, Andrea, Jessica, and Sharon, for this week's segment.
This simple, I'm going to break down tips into the different food groups, beginning with fruits and vegetables. My first tip is if you have fruit that's overripe, cut it up and freeze it to use it later in a smoothie, yogurt, or an oatmeal. To freeze it effectively, lay fruit in a single layer on a cookie sheet before you put it in the freezer. You can do the same thing with vegetables. For vegetables that are about to go off, put them in the freezer and then boil them in water later to make a great vegetable soup base. It can also be a good idea to stock up on long-lasting vegetables, which also tend to be the cheap ones. Try potatoes and yams, carrots, cabbage, and frozen vegetables when they're on sale. Fruits and vegetables are also an inexpensive alternative to prepared snack foods. For example, snap peas and baby carrots are easy to throw in a lunch bag. A good rule of thumb is that about half of your plate should be fruits and vegetables. Buying seasonal produce and checking what's on sale is a great way to get a variety for less money. A lot of whole grains are actually quite inexpensive, especially when they're available in bulk. I think that one of the common barriers is the time it actually takes to cook them. For example, wild rice takes 40 minutes to an hour to cook. The key here is honestly, plan ahead. That's what it comes down to. But one inexpensive and underused grain that you might want to check out is barley. you'll find two types of barley available, pearl and pot barley. Pearl is a little bit more processed and it cooks more quickly, while pot barley is higher in fiber. Both have a nutty flavor and you'll be able to find them in grocery stores even when there isn't a bulk section. All right, now for protein alternatives. Instead of salmon, try perch or canned light tuna for inexpensive and healthy fish options. You can also try black beans, chickpeas, lentils, and kidney beans. Aiming to replace meat with beans or legumes at least twice a week is a good benchmark. You can soak and cook dried beans to save money, or buy canned beans to save time. But if you're going to use canned beans, be sure you rinse them before using them. Eggs are also a complete source of protein that doesn't break the bank. Dairy, the last category here, tends to be one of the most expensive food groups. Fluid milk or soy milk is something that is probably worth the expense because it's nutrient dense and it's one of the few really good sources of vitamin D in our diet. But now other dairy foods, such as cheese, which is one of my favorite foods, tends to be really pricey. Cottage cheese is a high protein alternative that can be eaten plain with salt and pepper and green onions is what I like to put in it, or with fruit. And that can be a good alternative when cheese is just a little too expensive that week. Non-fat plain yogurt is usually also cheaper than other fruit yogurts or Greek yogurts. Just add your own fruit and it's just as tasty. That's all for me, but I'm going to pass it off to Sharon for some more practical, general tips.
Thanks, Lauren. So I'll just go through these really quickly here. So before you shop, make a list. So you've probably heard of this before, but it's because it works. So making a shopping list before you go really helps you to stick with what you need and not overspend. And skipping processed foods like frozen entrees, cookies, and soda is another great idea. So they're often more expensive than the healthier, freshly prepared alternatives. And you can easily make your own and freeze them and have them, you know, for a couple weeks. Canned foods are convenient, but fresh foods often have fewer additives, so keep that in mind. Now, the other point is that you want to cook and freeze large batches of one-dish foods like soups, curries, or lasagnas. It just makes it easier to plan how much you're going to spend per dish and makes it convenient to take for a leftover lunch or something. Also, you want to make sure that you're storing foods properly so that you're not wasting and throwing them out as often. So food safety is something to keep in mind when you're trying to stay on a budget. Now, I guess your take-home message here is that planning ahead, eating seasonally, and checking what's on sale are your best tips to stay in budget. And you want to store food properly and plan ways to use your leftovers or freeze them for later so that they don't go to waste. And variety is good for health and happiness.
Thanks for tuning in again this week.
If you missed us, please go to blogs.ubc.ca/dietetics intuition or follow us on Twitter at CITR Health and even like us on Facebook at Dietetics Intuition. Until next time, stay happy and healthy, Vancouver.
And thanks to Sharon and the girls from Dietetics Intuition for their story on low-cost foods. Remember, their Dietetics Intuition is on once a week with our local health tips. So now it's time for our interview with Assistant Professor William Chung from UBC's Department of Fisheries. He just helped to release a new study that's been showing that the changes in the temperature due to global warming are causing smaller fish. And so we want to talk about why these changes in ocean and climate systems could be leading to smaller fish. So, William, welcome to the show. Oh, hello, Professor Chung? Professor Chung?
Yes.
Oh, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi. So can you tell us a bit about what the study was?
Yeah, sure. In this study, I did this research that myself and my colleagues have been conducting in the last 2 years. What we are looking at is try to look at the effects of climate change and how that affects the body size of fish in the different ocean basins in the world oceans. So, and the major findings that we have for this study is that we find that climate change related to a change in the ocean conditions. For example, there is we are already seeing the ocean warming up in the last few decades, and that is we know that there are lots of scientific evidence that shows that the ocean will continue to change in the next few decades. So what we want to assess is how that would affect the body size of fish. So we use a computer simulation modeling approach to address that question. We, if a fish is animals in the ocean that breathe oxygen through water, and one of the things about that is that in water there's less oxygen compared to, for example, in atmospheric air, and it is more difficult for the fish to get oxygen through water. Mm-hmm. Particularly as the fish grow bigger and bigger, there are increasing body materials that would need oxygen for body function. However, the abilities of the fish to get oxygen do not increase proportionally. So as a result, at some point, the fish will stop growing. And particularly when the oceans warms up in the future, the fish bodies also increase in temperature. Increase in temperature results in an increase in the metabolic rate of fish, and increasing metabolic rate would require need more oxygen to support. And so these combinations of increased oxygen demand and as well as limitation of oxygen supply make the fish a window of oxygen in a smaller body size. So it's basically in a situation where the ocean temperature increase, the fish will stop growing at a smaller body size. So, another mechanism is that in our study, we know that in the tropical area or in warm water area, there are more small size fish species compared to, say, in cooler water or in high latitude region. So, and we know that there are ample scientific evidence and from our studies that these hot water or tropical species tends to shift to high latitude regions under global warming. And so, a lot of these small warm water species will shift their distributions to high latitude habitats. As a result, if you look at the fish communities by measuring the maximum body size of different fish species, you will also see a reduction in body size. So,
Professor Chang,
I find is that on average, there is a 14% to 24% reduction in body size by 2050 relative to now.
Professor Chang, I was wondering, are there particular areas in the ocean that are heating up faster than other areas around the world?
Yeah, I mean, the change in seawater temperatures is not uniform along around the ocean basin. There are some areas, for example, in the Northwest Pacific or in the Arctic regions that are increasing that warms up faster than other areas. But on average, what we find is that if we look at the whole ocean basin, the rate of decrease in the maximum body size are similar across ocean basins. So meaning that in the Pacific Ocean, in the Atlantic Oceans, or in the Indian Ocean, their rates are all around 14% to 24% in the next 50 years.
So what impact do you see this having on the fishing industry? Because we're already seeing that fish populations are dramatically decreasing in several parts of the world. So what impact will this have on that industry?
So we would expect that with a smaller body size of fish, it also affects other attributes such as growth rate and maturity size. And all of which affects the population dynamics. Everything being equal, a smaller body animals would actually result in a decrease in the overall biomass available for fisheries. So that would have a direct effect on fish catch as well as the supply of livelihood to human society. I mean, exactly how much that would be affected, we haven't pinpointed in our study. But we think that this is something that would need an urgent need to look at these issues. And so in the near future, our research will start to attempt to address this question.
So, Professor, did the computer simulation that this report used, did that computer simulation take into account acidification and particle pollution, so increasing plastic pollution in the ocean?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Actually, we didn't include ocean acidification or pollution, like plastic pollution, in this analysis. We can do that, but one of the reasons that we didn't is that, for example, for ocean acidification, right now we still don't have a very clear or good understanding on the impacts on fish population.
Right.
So there are starting to have quite a lot of different experiments that are being done by scientists from around the world looking into these issues. So hopefully in the near future, so we would have sufficient information that allow us to incorporate these factors into our study.
So, last question here. I know this is very broad, but what would you recommend as a scientist and a researcher to governments to do something about this?
Yeah, we know that to minimize these potential impacts from the changes that we reported in our study, one of the things that as human society can do is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Right.
So we know that by reducing greenhouse gas emissions, we will reduce the rate of climate change as well as reduce the rate of changing ocean conditions. So this will directly reduce the extent of impact on the ocean ecosystem from climate change. And secondly, we know that in a more healthy ecosystem of fish stocks tends to have better abilities or capabilities to handle external stress, such as changing environment. Imagine that there's a fish populations that are heavily overexploited, that their habitats are damaged, and that they live in the poor water quality. These populations will already be under as from other activities. Will be less compared to a fish population that is healthy, abundant, and with their habitats being intact.
All right, Professor, thank you so much for talking to us. And we definitely look forward to paying attention to this in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome. Bye.
All right, so that was Professor William Chung, who's an assistant professor at the UBC Fisheries Center and the head of the Changing Ocean Research Unit at UBC. All right, you're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. We are going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your global news.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard an interview with Professor William Chung, which you can hear once again on our website, citr.ca/news. We now go to our local weekday weather forecast, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Here's Phil Chang.
So, hey CJ, this is looking really good, actually. The low we were just in officially passed this morning, but the sun is already outside shining. And the GFS weather model is suggesting that it just may stay with us throughout this week. Like was mentioned on Friday, the big picture is we're now heading into a high pressure zone where very few clouds form. Humidity is low at 57%, so virtually no fog, and winds of up to 30 kilometers per hour tonight will mix up the atmosphere pretty good, I think. So that eliminates chances of haze. Putting all this together with a stable-looking upper air sounding from the Air Resource Laboratory, I think this will be a week of fair weather and great visibility starting tomorrow. Temperatures should average around 13 degrees here on UBC campus, according to our rooftop model. So now, to verify that, here's Environment Canada's official weather prediction for this week. Today, mainly cloudy with 40% chance of showers, high of 19, UV index of 3 or moderate. Tonight, mainly cloudy with 40% chance of showers early this evening, clearing late into this afternoon. Winds northwest, 30 kilometers per hour, increasing to 60 gusting, and possibly even 80 near midnight, low of 8. Tuesday, mainly cloudy, clearing in the afternoon, windy into the morning, high of 16. Wednesday, sunny, low of 6, high of 18. Thursday, sunny, low of 7, high of 17. And Friday, also sunny, low of 6, high of 18. So, great, there you have it. A sunny end. Your weather summary brought to you by the UBC Storm Club and Environment Canada. Enjoy the week, listeners, and please tune in to us, News 101, again on Friday for your weekend weather forecast. I'm Phil Chang.
Thank you, Phil. I'm really glad it's not raining anymore. All right, and that does it for our local and national news. We now go to our international news. Oh, I'm sorry. We do have our provincial and national headlines up next.
The British Columbian government has rejected plans for a copper and gold mine in Morrison Lake, citing the risk posed to the salmon in Skeena River. Pacific Booker Minerals Inc. had proposed the mine in the northwest of the province and planned to dig out 30,000 tons of copper and gold ore from the site each day over the next 21 years. The site is located on a 15-kilometer-long lake surrounded by crown land near Smithers. Situated at the headwaters of the Skeena River, this is the second largest source of sockeye salmon in the province. The province's environmental assessment found that the mine not only posed a risk to the salmon population, however, but also endangered water quality of this river. This decision was welcomed by the nearby Babine Lake First Nations, who had raised earlier concerns about the conservation of habitat and fish in the area if the mine was allowed to proceed.
Rancher Judith Guichon has been appointed to a 5-year term as British Columbia's new lieutenant governor. Prime Minister Stephen Harper announced Ms. Guichon's appointment in Ottawa on Monday, saluting her dedication to her community and the province, and her leading role in environmentally sound ranching and agriculture. Ms. Guichon, who owns and operates a ranch near Kamloops, succeeds Stephen L. Point, who was appointed to the lieutenant governor's post in October 2007. In a statement, Premier Christy Clark saluted Ms. Guichon's commitment to BC history and traditions, and said she has spent a lifetime ensuring British Columbians are connected with her roots. Quote, she never has just stood by, but always sought ways to bring her perspective forward in a positive fashion and make our province better, end quote.
Premier Christy Clark spent today in Alberta with Alberta Premier Alison Redford, with whom she is currently sharing a frosty relationship due to each province's stance on the Northern Gateway pipeline. The two premiers, who shared a close relationship until recently, have become divided due to Clark's insistence on 5 key guarantees for BC before the project can continue. These guarantees include successful completion of the environmental review process. In the case of the Northern Gateway pipeline project, that means a recommendation by the National Energy Board joint review panel that the project proceeded. World-leading marine oil spill response, prevention and recovery system for BC's coastline and ocean to manage and mitigate the risk and cost of heavy oil pipelines and shipment. The third guarantee is world-leading practices for land oil spill prevention, response, and recovery systems to manage and mitigate the risk and cost of heavy oil pipeline. Fourthly, legal requirements regarding Aboriginal treaty rights are to be addressed, and First Nations are to be provided with opportunities, information, and resources necessary to participate and benefit from the heavy oil project. Fifth but not least, that British Columbia receives a fair share of the fiscal and economic benefits of a proposed heavy oil project that reflects the level of the risk borne by the government, the environment, as well as BC's taxpayers. Redfort has bluntly rejected these terms during the summer, and Clark has been pointing at the Albertan media for wrongly interpreting the province's demands, while she insists that, quote, "Yes, we want our fair share, but we are not going to do it at the expense of our environment. This debate is about making sure we protect our environment first and foremost," end quote. Redfort, on the other hand, has said that BC's proposal to share the benefits of Alberta's resources would mean, quote, "fundamentally changing Confederation," end quote.
Guantanamo detainee Omar Khadr, who was transferred to a prison in his Canadian homeland over the weekend, is having a difficult time adapting to his new circumstances, one of the inmates' lawyers said on Monday. Khadr, the youngest prisoner and last Westerner held in the U.S. military prison on Cuban soil, returned to Canada on Saturday to finish his sentence. He had spent almost 10 years in Guantanamo. He was 15 years old, 1-5, that is, when captured in Afghanistan and later confessed to killing a U.S. soldier and conspiring with Al-Qaeda. As part of the deal with prosecutors, he pleaded guilty in 2010 and was sentenced to 8 years in prison. Omar Khadr, 26, is now in Millhaven Top Security Jail in the central Canadian province of Ontario, waiting for authorities to decide how best to handle his case. He will be eligible for parole in the mid-2013.
The huge recall of Canadian beef because of E. coli contamination is unlikely to slow that country's beef consumption or its exports, analysts say, largely because the public has become familiar with E. coli. On Friday, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, FCIA, temporarily shut down Private Hell XL Foods' beef packing plant at Brooks, Alberta, where products containing the potentially deadly bacteria were made. The CFIA also recalled millions of pounds of beef products, including ground beef, steak, right from the plant. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, which stopped importing beef from the plants in mid-September, is recalling beef in more than 30 states. Meat buyers from importing countries are unlikely to be rattled by a risk that they are well aware of, said Kevin Greer, senior market analyst at George Morris Center, a Canadian agriculture think tank. Canada is the world's sixth largest exporter of beef and veal.
And those are your provincial and national headlines here on News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. We now go to our international news brought to you by Free Speech Radio.
FSR in headlines. Another U.S. soldier died in Afghanistan over the weekend. The Associated Press says it's the 2,000th member of the U.S. military to die in the longest war in U.S. history. The attack happened at a checkpoint, but reports conflict about the details. The number of civilians killed in the 11-year war is not known, but most estimates say at least 20,000 have died. In October 2001, The U.S. led a coalition force to Afghanistan to oust the Taliban and rout al-Qaeda. The U.S. still has almost 70,000 service members in the country, along with their coalition colleagues and contractors. In Iraq, another series of bombs killed at least I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. Another U.S. soldier died in Afghanistan over the weekend. The U.S. still has almost 70,000 service members in the country, along with their coalition colleagues and contractors. In Iraq, another series of bombs killed at least 26 people yesterday, bringing the total dead there in September to 365. The attacks struck Shiite targets, and according to Hakim al-Zamili, a Shia member of parliament, the situation in Iraq is still unstable and shows that security forces are still unqualified to deal with the terrorists. California Governor Jerry Brown was busy signing laws this weekend, including a measure that bans so-called treatment for gay kids that tries to make them straight. He also signed a bill that gives juvenile offenders sentenced to life without parole another chance at freedom, and he gave the okay to driver's licenses for undocumented youth. But he wielded the veto pen as well, and immigrant rights activists say two of their top priorities were blocked. KPFA's Christopher Martinez explains.
Immigrant rights activists collected petitions, held prayer vigils, and even sent flowers to California Governor Jerry Brown, urging him to sign a pair of measures to limit deportations and grant basic workers' rights to housekeepers and other domestic workers. But late Sunday, Brown vetoed both measures. The bills were a top priority for the California Immigrant Policy Center. Reshma Shamasundar, the center's director, says she sees the vetoes as Brown turning his back on immigrant communities.
This was Governor Brown's opportunity to be a champion, for California to be a leader. Instead, he's failed us. Instead, you know, thousands of families will continue to be separated, immigrants deported. And domestic workers won't have access to the types of labor protections that, you know, most other workers enjoyed.
The Domestic Workers Bill of Rights would have given California's 200,000 domestic workers, most of them immigrant women, the right to overtime pay and meal and rest breaks. It's similar to a measure recently enacted in New York State. The other bill, called the Trust Act, would have limited local police participation in the federal Secure Communities program that has led to the deportation of almost 80,000 undocumented Californians. Activists say they'll continue the struggle in the legislature and in the courts. Christopher Martinez, FSRN, Berkeley.
Security forces patrol a Bangladesh village today after weekend rioters burned down at least 13 Buddhist temples and monasteries, along with dozens of houses. The violence started after a picture of a burnt Quran appeared on Facebook. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari reports.
Police have arrested more than 150 people and are looking for 1,500 more in connection with the violence and arson. On Saturday, Muslims, already angry over an anti-Islam film made in the United States, attacked a Buddhist-majority village in Cox Bazar. They ransacked homes and torched Buddhist monasteries and temples. The violence later spread to the neighboring Chittagong district and continued through the night until security forces reached the area early Sunday. Buddhists staged a silent protest in the capital Dhaka on Sunday afternoon. A heavy contingent of security forces is now patrolling and public gatherings have been banned in the Buddhist-dominated areas. Senior officials say the man who posted the image that started the violence has been detained and is in protective custody. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari, FSRN.
Hundreds of protesters marched in Chicago yesterday, calling for more jobs for blacks. The rally was called by prominent black Chicago businessman, 87-year-old Ed Gardner, who stopped work at the same job site last week after he drove by and saw no black workers. A few marchers spoke to Chicago's CBS 2 News.
We're concerned about black people working, not necessarily minorities. Minorities got their jobs, the black people don't.
This may be groundbreaking because you have a retired senator, you have retired judges, you have the president of Chicago State University, you have black millionaires.
It's a shame that an 87-year-old man had to stop his car and come out here to protest us.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel says the city has strict hiring rules and they must be enforced. The company said there were no black union cement layers available for hire. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
The bureau chief in Tehran for the news agency Reuters is facing a court sentence this week over so-called propaganda-related offenses for a headline posted earlier this year. According to the AP, Parisa Hafesi, who is an Iranian citizen, was convicted Sunday by a special media court in Iran. At issue is a headline for a video Reuters posted in February that initially described a group of women in martial arts training as, quote, assassins. After the story, the Iranian government suspended the Reuters bureau in Tehran and most of the staff left the country, but Hafesi was not allowed to leave, according to the AP. In October 2011, FSRN sat down with Hafesi in Los Angeles when she was visiting to receive a Courage in Journalism Award from the International Women's Media Foundation. She began by answering why she stayed in Iran following the 2009 protests, even after she and her staff came under increasing pressure.
Because this is my job. Our job is not to run away or to flee the pressure. Our job is to remain there, find a way to report correctly. That's what I believe and I have always believed in. So that's why I chose to stay. And I prefer to be there and to experience that pressure but to report correctly.
In early 2010, during a time when reform leaders called for anti-government protests to restart, Hafesi was abducted, detained, and faced interrogation. She described what she sees as the role of an independent media in Iran.
Our job is to report impartially. Our job is to understand the facts and reflect it and convey that message to the world without being afraid of pressures that we get. This is our job, and we are doing that. Me and many of my colleagues in Iran who chose to stay in Iran.
That's Parisa Hafesi, Reuters bureau chief for Tehran, speaking to FSRN October 2011. On Sunday, Hafesi was convicted in a media court in Iran. The Committee to Protect Journalists lists Iran as one of the top censored countries for media in the world. As of December 2011, 42 journalists were held in custody, the highest documented by the organization in the world. In Russia, a scheduled appeal hearing for three members of the feminist punk band Pussy Riot was postponed today after one of the defendants refused the representation of her lawyers. The move was unexpected, and the reasons for the refusal are unclear. Out in the streets, supporters gathered for a global day of action in support of the band members, who were sentenced in August to 2 years in jail. The Pussy Riot case is leading to legal efforts to further restrict social freedoms in Russia in an effort some call dangerous. FSRN's Ekaterina Danilova reports.
Dozens of activists gathered in St. Petersburg to call for the release of the three band members from jail. They also called for all political prisoners to be let free and for an end to legal measures restricting social freedoms. Pavel is a member of the anarcho-communist group Autonomous Movement.
We came here today to say no to all this tyranny of the police that is happening in our country, to say no to all these false charges, huge amounts of which are brought in our country, all the false evidence of policemen and judges who are bribed.
Pussy Riot's imprisonment for performing an anti-Putin song in a Moscow cathedral in February has spurred sympathetic political actions against the Orthodox Church. For example, a feminist group cut down a cross outside a church in Kyiv. This in turn has sparked legislation criminalizing criticism of the church, which was just introduced in the parliament. If passed, the law would create a penalty of up to 3 years in prison for insulting believers' feelings. Olga Kurnosova is an opposition leader who opposes the measure.
It's absolutely clear that the law appeared mainly in connection with Pussy Riot, but it confirms one more time that they are in jail because of an unjust sentence.
Vyacheslav Plakhatnyuk is a political lawyer. He says that such a law would be harmful and could start a process of religious radicalization.
I think that this type of legislative development is harmful because we will orient our society to search for manifestations of anti-religious behavior. On the whole, I think this additional restriction of human rights is absolutely unnecessary.
The legislation criminalizing criticism of religious persons will be discussed in Parliament this fall. The Pussy Riot appeal hearing is set to continue next week. Екатерина Данилова, FSRN, Russia.
Thanks to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that is our program for today, Monday, October 1st. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, please join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm...